Testing 1, 2 on your father's faith.
Yeah, episode 105. Last we left you, this is Scott, that's Pastor Jeff. Last we left you, we were in the middle of a magic trick. You know, it's the classic magic trick where the magician has the coffin-like box on the stage. He puts his beautiful young female assistant in the box. Then he saws through her body. They separate, you know, and her feet, and of course her hands and her head are still moving.
Right.
Now we're putting the box back together to discover that she wasn't sawed in half, and that the one part and the second part actually go back together, and no one has died in the process. That's where we left you last.
Super! Wow.
We were.
I want to know one thing. How many days have you been thinking about that intro to this podcast?
So, yeah, this is the two-parter. So this is the second part. This is her feet that are still moving in the box, separated, you know, as he's rolled them apart.
Right.
And we're putting them back together.
Good.
So we have been profiling Pastor Jeff. Mm-hmm. And last we left you in episode 104, we had kind of, if I remember correctly, we talked about seminary school. We talked about your trade work. We talked about your insurance work. We talked about you eventually traveling and learning French.
How I met Michelle.
How you met Michelle, and then
our assignment in Africa,
and then how you started the missionary work, and then we ran out of time.
Yeah. Yeah. So one thing, I'll kind of finish that story up.
Yeah, please.
Until we get into this. But then you said you wanted to ask some things about Africa. So let me just go on. When we were missionaries in Africa, we spent some time in training. We were in France for about 17 months learning French. Went to Cameroon.
And I asked the question, why did you need to learn French?
Right. And they were...
Because most of the...
Africa was colonized by... either the French, the Belgians, or the Brits, one by the Spaniards. That's Equatorial Guinea.
So that explains your British accent that you break out in just once in a while without any warning whatsoever.
Exactly. And so we went to Africa and worked in Congo with Wycliffe Bible Translators. And
you were dressed like in grass skirts, and you lived in a grass hut. Is this correct?
Exactly right. you saw that picture.
Now, will you describe? I don't know that I've ever heard you tell me exactly what environment you were living in, because we have this idea, those of us ignorant about what we're going to find in most places in Africa. I see you in the bush.
Well,
you know.
that's not ignorant, but the bush is like that. You know,
right.
I mean, in our training in Cameroon, we lived for 3 weeks, we lived in a mud hut with a thatched roof, slept on a bed made out of bamboo, a dirt floor. We did that for 3 weeks of our training. We worked in the capital city of Brazzaville, of the Republic of Congo. Now, I say capital city. That country had been through three civil wars in 5 years before we got there. So it was pretty much devastated. And so when I say capital city, you know, you're thinking of Pittsburgh, you know, or a city that you're from. And it's nothing like that. You know what I mean? Like electricity was spotty at best. You know, when we first got there, it was maybe 50-50 electricity.
And the Wi-Fi was just horrible. Could never see Netflix through a whole program.
You couldn't get through a whole program. It always locked up on you. So it was, we did have internet though, actually. We had to, because that was a lot of our work being done, uh-huh. You know, over internet and so forth. But that's only when you have electricity, you know. And so one of the things that I did there at the center is I put together a grant proposal to get some funds. I think it was like $60,000 or something to get a diesel generator put in, because we had to have electricity during work. And so this big, massive diesel generator that was 5 feet wide, 6 feet high, 10 feet long, right? When electricity went out, it would kick on. And so we had power, we had lights,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, during our working hours, because everything was done. We were working all over Africa. And so it was like, you know, communicating back with the United States, with Europe, with all the different, divisions of Wycliffe. And so anyways, that's what I did. I was the director there, and we had a great time in ministry there and everything.
So just describe the office setting.
That's what I'm going to do. So it was Wycliffe, or SIL, who we worked with, bought the old Korean embassy. So it was an embassy over there. And on there, there was an office building, there were two apartment buildings, and then there was a annex in the back with just little single apartments. And so these apartments were much like this basement right here, just block walls. The windows would just be louvered windows, nothing sealed off, with screens on there,
mm-hmm.
and with like bars, like burglar bars on it. You know?
Gotcha.
And it was just and they were tile floor, just big, these big tile floor that you could get tile over there, you know, like ceramic tile floor. So it was very kind of just cold and, you know, just simple.
Yeah.
And we had a little kitchen, our refrigerator, a little propane refrigerator.
Now, is this the apartment or the office?
Just the apartment. Okay. The office was pretty much the same thing. It was just a regular office building.
So you lived on that, on the property you're
on
describing.
The property, right.
Right. Okay.
A little two-bedroom apartment. Bedroom on one side, bedroom on this side. Each had their own bathroom. Living room here, dining room here, and a little, like a galley kitchen.
Did you require any kind of security?
We had 24-hour security.
Okay.
But it wasn't like we had a guard with a machine gun. It was a guy that stood out by the gate, and he had a machete.
So it's not like Mexico where you see everyone at every corner with a machine gun.
It wasn't like that at all. It wasn't like that at all. But, you know, we felt pretty safe there.
Yeah.
You know, even if it was at times it may have been a false sense of security, but we felt pretty safe.
You know? So you had laundry facilities there, and, I mean, kind of what was everyday life like?
So everyday life. So you had to go shopping, like, every day for food because—
Like a fresh food market?
Because it was an outdoor market.
Yeah.
And you had to go get your—and they picked things ready to eat. They wouldn't pick it, green, and then you brought it home and it sat there. When you picked it, it was—when you bought it, it was ready to eat.
Yeah.
So if you let it go another day or two, it was spoiled.
Wow.
So you shopped every other day at best, right? Every other day. And you know, as part of the economy over there, everybody had somebody working for them. Even Africans did. Africans would have somebody working in their house, and those people would have somebody working in their house. So we had somebody that worked with us. She'd come during the day, and Michelle actually taught her how to cook different things. You know, stuff that we make, taught her how to cook, and she would make African food for us, and she would clean the apartment or whatever, you know, while, because Michelle worked too, you know, she taught the boys and so forth, and
this is customary?
Yeah, I said, even the lady that worked with us, Natalie, her name was, at home, she has somebody in her home working for her.
Okay.
So everybody, this is just kind
That's
of part
the
of
the culture.
Part of the culture, part of the keeping the economy going, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah, and so that every day, you know, Michelle would do the shopping, or she would do the shopping, you know. If she did the shopping, she'd get better prices than us, you know.
Yeah.
If they saw Michelle coming in, of course, all the prices went up on everything, you know.
Right, right.
So she would do the shopping and the cooking, and we would have try to have her sit down and eat with us, and that's not part of the culture either. She would sit on the floor, little stool in the kitchen and eat. Every once in a while, she would join us, but that made her feel uncomfortable. Like, you're not supposed to do that.
Right.
You know, we thought, well, you know, it's okay with us, but it doesn't matter if it's okay with us. If how do they feel about it, you know?
Right.
So some interesting things. Like, one of the things about Africa is, part of that culture is if I come to your house and it's dinner time, right? Well, number one, I know not to come at dinner time.
Okay.
But if I did... Stop at your house. Right? Hey, we're eating right now. Can you come back or whatever? Right, that sort of thing. And so that was like that. So that's part of our culture. So I'd be eating, and a pastor would come and visit me, knock on the guard would come and say, you know, Jeff, so and so is here to meet with you. I said, okay, have him sit outside in the thing. I'll be right out there. And after a while, even though I knew this, after a while, my right-hand man, Rock Bunkusu, came to me and he said, real gentle-like, and he said, you know, can I talk to you a little bit? And he said, yeah. He said, I saw that his name was Raul, Pastor Raul, came to visit me. And I said, yeah, he comes, you know, occasionally. He said, I noticed he was sitting out there in the, they call it a payote, a little covered little thing. I said, yeah. He said, did you not have enough food? Some question like that. And I realized then, that's not what you do. Hospitality is so important over there. Somebody comes to dinner time, they come right in. They come right in and sit down. You're going to sit down and you eat with us, and you always prepare more food than you need, because you do that in expectation that somebody's going to come. So you're never surprised. So somebody comes, you're ready for them.
Right.
That's just part of the culture, which is really, really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's so much talk about Africa. But let me get to the church now. So we end up, after 4 years of serving, you come home for a year of furlough. We came home, and we had found out before we came home a couple months that Michelle was pregnant. So we're planning for our third child. Came home from Africa. And
so Brock, your youngest, was born in Africa.
No, he was born here.
He was born here, okay.
Yeah, we went, when we went, Brock was five, Brent was seven when we left, something like
oh,
that.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay.
And then we're coming home, you know, they're older. And
you know, you're in North Carolina at this time?
That's where we left from.
Right.
Yeah. That's where Brock was born in North Carolina.
Okay.
Brent was born in Michigan.
Okay.
I was born in Pennsylvania.
Let me write this down.
So we came back with an intention of being home for a year furlough and then going back to Africa. And we lost our baby in childbirth, or right at the time of childbirth. And so that was kind of, you know, pretty devastating, pretty hard for us. And, you know, I won't get into the whole story. I can answer any questions you might ask. But, you know, I made a choice, felt directed to not go back to Africa and start a church. Went to Michelle and told Michelle, and she was kind of shocked about that because she never saw herself as a pastor's wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never saw myself as a pastor really either, but I really felt pretty strongly about it. And so we ended up doing that, staying home, and we started the church in the house over there by where I live now.
Well, how did you end up? So when you returned from Africa, you came to Pittsburgh or you went to North Carolina?
I came to Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And I lived in that house across the street from where I live now.
Yeah.
A friend of mine owned that, and I moved in there and helped fix it up.
Okay.
So we came back here because my family was here. Michelle's family, father was down in Missouri, but he was a missionary. Michigan, neither of us really wanted to go to Michigan, even though she still had family there.
Right.
North Carolina, didn't really know anybody down there. We could have went to Florida. I knew a lot of people down there. But we thought, well, Pennsylvania would be a good place. We have family here, and it would be a good place to go out and travel from. Because we went to Texas, we went to Oklahoma, we went to mm-hmm. California, we went to North Carolina, went to Florida, raising support. And so when we decided not to go back, we were already living here. So that was the choice to stay
gotcha,
here,
gotcha.
Start the church here. So then we did that. We started Freedom Life Center in our house and was there for about maybe 2 months. And it's just too many people to fit in the house. So we looked for a place. We found this place for sale and got it after like... No, actually, we were in my house for like 11 months, because it was 11 months that we bought this building right here.
So when you were a missionary in Africa, did at that time when you were living that life, you thought this is my
I thought
life.
I thought I'd die
this,
in Africa.
This is it.
Yep, I thought I'd die in Africa. That was my. I just thought that's what I am. That's what I do. That's what God wants me to do.
Right.
You know, and
talk about what it takes to fund that too.
Yeah. So, I mean, every, you know, the different denomination has their own ways of doing it. Like, for example, we had friends that were part of a Baptist denomination, and they would give them a certain support. And because each church had to give to their missions department, their national missions department, and the national missions department would support missionaries, and it was just the missionary's job then to go around, and they put them on a circuit, and they would speak on churches like every Sunday around their denomination, wherever denomination set.
Trying to bolster support.
Well, I mean, the support came automatically.
Oh, okay.
So like that, like the churches automatically gave a certain percentage of their income to the missions department of that denomination. Then the denomination said, we're going to support this missionary. We're going to give you X amount.
Gotcha.
And just gave it to them. That's the way one worked. Ours worked differently with Wycliffe. With Wycliffe, you had to raise your own support. And they didn't tell you how to do it. They didn't tell you where to do it. You just had to.
But you were working for someone, providing them a service. So there was no income from that?
No, nothing like that. You had to, because you can't work overseas. You can't work in another country. So you can't get an income there. So you had to go fully support it, even though we did Bible translation. We were really doing it for us, you know what I mean?
Okay.
And then we would give the translations to the churches. So we had to find our own support. So let's say I was doing that now, right? I might come talk to you and Marianne and say, hey, Michelle and I decided we're going to be on a mission field.
We're not home.
We're raising support, yeah. And so would you support us, you know, $2,000 a month? Could you afford that much? which I know
we're not home.
I know you guys. And so, yeah, so, you know, my friend Jeff Williams, who's been on the podcast, mm-hmm. Their church, we actually were in Texas for a while working in his church as we were getting training. And I worked as his kind of missions pastor for about 10 months. And when we left, we had a big service, and he had everybody say, listen, we want to support Jeff and Michelle, their work, what they're doing. So we're going to send out cards. Write on the card how much you're willing in the next 4 years to give every single month for 4 years.
This is to his parishioners.
His parishioners.
Gotcha.
To their support.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so at that time, after it was all said and done, they added it all up, and Jeff got up and he said, well, I'm kind of surprised. He said, I was actually hoping for about $500 a month. I thought we could probably do $500 a month. That's what I was hoping for. And what came in was $1,000.
Yeah.
$1,000 a month. So they supported us $1,000 a month. And our budget was only like $3,500 a month. And so the rest of it came from individuals. For example, Pete and Connie supported us when we were over there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, different family members. Then churches. We'd go around speaking at churches. There were churches in Florida that supported us, North Carolina, one in New York, Oklahoma, Texas, Pennsylvania here, number in Pennsylvania, number in Michigan supported us. So from all around, we got our support that way.
And you've had, it's been a while, but haven't you supported missionary work through this church as well?
Yes. Yeah.
There was a couple I recall of 2-3 years ago that might have been in church and you.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
And our father we support.
Okay.
And we support some African nationals, the work that they're doing. Our church supports people like that as well.
Right.
And then we've supported individuals ourselves. You know, supported, you know, friends that are missionaries and
right.
that sort of thing. Yeah. So that's kind of the journey. You know what I mean? Now there's a lot that happened in those things, but that's like the highlights of how we got to where we are right now. You know, Pastor, now we've been here for, what did Michelle say Sunday? 15 years.
Yeah. Or in your 15th year, I forget, but yeah, 15 was the number.
This is our 15th year. November will be a 15 year
gotcha.
Anniversary.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're 63.
Oh, you're 65.
Six. What's the next chapter? So we cut you in half. Now we've cut your feet off. So you're in thirds now. We're going to put those feet back on once we, you know, saw them. What's the next chapter, the final chapter in the Jeffrey Winters story?
You know, it's hard to tell, Scott. That's actually
don't cop out on me.
No, no, I'm going to tell you. It's a good question.
Yeah,
and you know, you have to plan. You have to have ideas of what you want to do, and so right now, because of you know what this is like, life situation. You know, with my aunt, she was in church past Sunday, 89.
Right.
Well, I'm her only family. You know, I can't very well leave here. We would like to retire someday in Florida.
Right.
That would be ideal for us. Now. You know what that's like. You have grandkids already.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Take Marianne away from her grandkids.
Not going to happen.
No, that's not going to happen.
Right.
So I don't know. How will Michelle be? How will I be? You don't know until you have grandkids, right?
Right.
So, you know, I assume that Brent and Annie will have grandkids one day, you know, maybe hopefully sooner rather than later. So that's a factor. I'm still loving what I do, pastoring at 63. I mean, I could see me pastoring for another 5 years. I could see out 5 years and say, I could do this for another 5 years,
you know, right.
at least.
Right.
Beyond that, I don't know. But 5 years, I mean, I enjoy it. I enjoy the life of the church. I'd have a hard time giving up this podcast.
Oh, you're committed for life for this.
Yeah. You see, you know what I'm saying? So there's those factors. You know,
right.
What about my aunt? What about grandkids? And so you have an idea that, you know, eventually you want to retire. And so I'm 63. I don't see me retiring at 65. I don't see me retiring in 2 years.
Right.
I just don't see that happening. I actually don't want to because I really enjoy, you know, what I'm doing. But 5 years from now, you know, maybe see what the grandkids situation is, see where my aunt's at in her life. You know, by then she might be living with us.
Right.
Well, that's another issue. So I can't say definitively, but that's the direction, I think. You know,
you have some hobbies. Do you see any of those developing, you know, as you think about
retirement?
Well, having more time and
yeah.
Whether it's just a hobby or maybe even some income.
Yeah. I'd like to, actually, because I enjoy the leather craft. I enjoy that work. You know, the woodworking I enjoy too. But like you just said, you know, there's, you know, with pastoring, with the houses that I work on, there's not much time for those hobby things right now, unfortunately.
Right.
You know, but yeah, I mean, retirement, like, I mean, you know, I see how enjoyable it is for you, except when you have a project, right? When you can pick and, you know, it doesn't
right.
Stress. When you pick and choose, it's fun.
Right.
It doesn't stress you out.
Something you learn, by the way.
Yeah.
So with the pottery I took up during, actually that was during COVID.
Right.
And I just was like, oh, let me bring that back from high school years. And I have a Bamba Bird. Am I saying her business right? Anyway, we have a friend that's a professional potter in town.
Yeah.
She's unbelievably, tremendously gifted.
Yeah.
And looking at her site and how she sells, you know, one of the big things in capital letters you'll see with her and a lot of other artists is no custom orders. No custom orders, because it's hard, it's time consuming, it can lead to all kinds of issues. And when you allow someone to help you develop something, create something, then there's a license for them to kind of take over too. So it really needs to be about what you want to put into it, what projects you want to take on.
I see.
So if I want to make a whole series of mugs, you know, I was going to do mugs for a coffee shop in Lexington, Kentucky.
Oh yeah,
where my sister
right.
and mother live,
mm-hmm.
And got real close. We were a little bit apart in terms of price, but I realized that could be a real can of worms too,
uh-huh.
Because then I'm they have control of the logo, which I was going to develop and you know all that.
Right.
But then if there were, you know, if they didn't exactly like the shape or they didn't exactly like the handles or they didn't, you know, it's like, no, here's my products.
Yeah.
And you learn what people want and you make that based on what you think, you know, people would like as a gift or to buy.
So make 400 mugs and then say, hey, 400 mugs here. Are you interested?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, with your leather work, you know, maybe you turn that into a business because I could with the pottery and I choose not to.
Right.
It's like, you know, I make a little bit of money, but most of it's, you know, gifts and it's just for the enjoyment.
Right.
So, and to me, my brother-in-law in Lexington, I mean, he retired several years ago and all he does is work.
Really?
Which is what he loves. It's his passion.
What does he do?
He's into to tech. For computer tech companies, so he sets up. I'm not even sure exactly what he does.
Okay,
but
he retired, but kept working in the same field, basically.
Right, and gotcha. He has all these. He consults all kinds of businesses, and still travels a lot. And
yeah.
You know, crazy man. But he controls it too. That's the difference in retirement. He was working for Xerox, I believe, was the company that eventually bought the company he'd worked for years. So.
Mm.
So, and that's the biggest plus for retirement, in my opinion, is you make the choices.
You make the choices, right.
Right. So whatever you want to do, unless you need the income, then the tail is wagging the dog again. But
Mm-hmm.
So what, more importantly, what does Michelle want to do? Does she want to stay with you? have you had these discussions?
No,
she wants to retire from Jeff.
No, but I think her and Marianne have had this conversation.
I deserve that.
you know, marriage. You know, you have your ups and downs in marriage, and we seem to be in a good place now. I think you and Marianne seem to be in a pretty good place.
Well, we joke, and sometimes people that don't know us well don't get it when we start having this almost rehearsed discussion now about how, you know, we're too old and too fragile, I don't know, too whatever, to make a change. We just decided that, you know, we kind of like each other. We're going to stick it out. You know, some people look at us like, oh, my God, really? They're serious? Well, we are serious, but no, we're not. You know, this is it. We've been together long enough to, I think, understand that there's ups and downs and we're going to have good times, bad times, and but no one's going anywhere.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But it does take two. So I'm speaking from my half.
Can I tell you what Marianne has said? No, it's so true, Scott. You know, the thing is that, you know, looking back, and of course, everybody knows what I'm about to say, but you look back at all the hard times. Those are the things that kept you together, getting through those hard times together. They're the ones, those are the things that are the glue that kept you together.
Absolutely.
Getting through those things. It's not the trips to Waco, Texas that are so,
right.
You know what I mean? The great trips that are the things that are the binder that holds you together.
Right, right.
It's getting through those difficult times in life, yeah.
So what do we profiled me in music a few episodes ago, so we've chronicled your life a little bit. What's next on Not Your Father's Faith? We're going to talk to Dave Stradling sooner. New York.
We'll get Dave on here again about his new book and his life's journey here a little bit. And I'd get Jeff back on here, Jeff from Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Get him back on here again, too.
Yeah.
We tend to, you know, like having guests like that, you know. It takes the pressure off of you.
Definitely make us sound better. There's no question about that.
Next week, let's shoot to have Dave on.
All right. We can talk about the book.
Yep.
I'm Not Your Father's Faith.